From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, Jim Jarmusch talks about writing and directing his new film, Patterson, starring Adam Driver as a poet and bus driver named Patterson who lives in Patterson, New Jersey.
You drive the bus, right?
Yeah, I do.
Your name really Patterson, or they just nickname you that?
No, my real name is Patterson.
Well, that's kind of crazy, right?
Also, Dr. Heider Verreich, author of Modern Death, described some of the difficult decisions presented by life-extending medical technologies.
The patient who had been almost unresponsive and came to life, his eyes were wide open and he was looking right at us. And he started to scream, "Kill me," again and again.
And David Edelstein reviews The Salesman by Iranian director Asghar Farhadi. It's nominated for an Oscar, but Farhadi won't attend the ceremony because of President Trump's travel ban. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is screenwriter and director Jim Jarmusch. His new movie, Patterson, stars Adam Driver as a bus driver and poet named Patterson, who lives and works in Patterson, New Jersey, and is inspired by William Carlos Williams and his epic poem, Patterson. The poems Patterson writes in the film are inspired by what he observes in the daily routines of his life. Almost all the poems used in the film were actually written by poet Ron Padgett. New Yorker film critic Richard Brody wrote, "Jarmusch has made a movie that's filled with poetry and that is a poem in itself." We're going to talk about movies, poetry, and music, three of Jarmusch's passions. The rapper Method Man has a cameo in the new film. Jarmusch recently made a documentary about the punk band Iggy and the Stooges. His other films include Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, Coffee and Cigarettes, Dead Man, Ghost Dog, and Only Lovers Left Alive. Let's start with a scene from Patterson, in which Patterson is driving his bus as one of his poems is going through his mind.
Another one. When you're a child, you learn there are three dimensions: height, width, and depth. Like a shoebox. Then later you hear there's a fourth dimension: time. Then some say there can be 5, 6, 7. I knock off work, have a beer at the bar. I look down at the glass and feel glad.
That's Adam Driver in Jim Jarmusch's new movie. Jim Jarmusch, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you want to make a film about a poet who drives a bus or a bus driver who writes poetry, depending on how you want to look at it?
Well, I visited Patterson many years ago, 20-some years ago, as a kind of day trip because of William Carlos Williams, because of Allen Ginsberg having lived there. And I went to the Great Falls and sat really in the exact same spot as Adam Driver does, as Patterson. And I walked around the factory buildings, and I was reading at the time the epic-length poem Patterson by Williams. And it just really just stayed with me. And I had this idea for a long time to make a film about a poet in Patterson, named Patterson. I wanted him to be working class. Eventually, I thought a bus was a perfect visual way to move him, to drift him through the city, to have a measured kind of routine lifestyle. And all these things kind of congealed into the film Patterson eventually.
I love that your movie is so much about a poet and poetry, since, you know, it's not a typical subject for movies, and you wanted to be a poet before you became a filmmaker. So when you were studying poetry with Kenneth Koch, what were some of the things he taught you about language and about observation?
Well, he taught us so many things. He taught us to be playful, to be very appreciative of other poets, to appreciate all forms of expression. He taught us to be experimental. And Kenneth Koch taught, there's a great book called Rose, Where Did You Get That Red?, a collection of poems that comes from a poem that a child wrote. He taught children in public schools in New York City to write poems and told them, don't worry about rhyming, don't worry about any of that stuff, you know, write a poem where you mention three colors and make it five lines, or he would just give them, you know, little strategies, and man, they wrote some great poems.
Well, there's a scene in Patterson where Adam Driver's character, the poet and bus driver, is walking home from the bus depot, and he sees sitting on this kind of concrete ledge a 10-year-old girl who's all alone. It's not a great neighborhood, and so he's concerned about her safety, so he sits down next to her. And it turns out her mother and her sister will be back in a couple of minutes. But in the meantime, he sees that she has one of those like pink little girl journals with a little lock on it. And he says, what do you write in it? And it turns out she writes poetry. So I want to play that scene, and it includes a poem that she wrote. And I'll mention this is actually a poem that you wrote for the film, so I want our listeners to listen to it, and then I'm going to ask you about writing it. So This is Adam Driver, and the girl is played by Sterling Gerrans, and this is a scene from Patterson.
Are you interested in poetry?
Actually, I am, kind of.
Really?
Yeah.
I write poetry. I keep it all in this notebook. Secret notebook.
Oh, you're a poet?
Yeah.
That's great.
Would you like to hear one?
Sure, sure.
It doesn't really rhyme, though.
That's okay. I kind of like them better when they don't.
Yeah, me too. Okay. This one's called Waterfalls. Two words, though. That.
Waterfalls. Okay.
Okay. Waterfalls. Waterfalls from the bright air. It falls like hair, falling across a young girl's shoulders. Waterfalls, making pools in the asphalt, dirty mirrors with clouds and buildings inside. It falls on the roof of my house, it falls on my mother and on my hair. Most people call it rain.
That's a beautiful poem.
You really liked it?
Yeah, I really do. I think it's beautiful. Waterfalls. Thank you.
What a nice scene. So, Jim Jarmusch, you wrote the poem that the little girl reads. What did you try to do when you were writing the poem, and was it liberating at all to be writing in the voice of somebody very different from you?
Yeah, it was. Really what I was trying to do was imitate, in a way, the poems that Kenneth Koch got kids to write. So I was remembering those and those kind of strategies. So I was just trying to be her for a minute, and I wasn't really satisfied with the poem. And when Ron Padgett did agree to write the poems for the film in Patterson's voice, I did ask him, I said, now, do you want to write one for the girl? I wrote one in there, but I think you might want to write a better poem for her. And he said, no, I like that one. That's perfect for her. So I kept that in there. It's not my poem, but it's me sort of channeling her and writing a poem for her.
So she writes her poems in a secret notebook. Patterson writes his poems in a secret notebook that he shows to no one, not even his wife. Did you have a notebook like that too? Were you very reticent about showing poems to anybody?
Yes, I still do have my secret notebook.
Why do you keep them a secret? I mean, you have a public body of work, your movies.
Well, I don't know. I feel I'm not really that confident in them. I will do a reading later this year in April at Princeton with John Ashbery, because he asked me to, and I love John Ashbery. He's really the poet laureate of English language poetry, whether he's given that or not, he is to me. But I'm just a little shy of that. I don't know.
The poems in your movie, in the movie Patterson, are the poems of somebody who has a daily routine. And the poems of are the poems of somebody who is observing things while living a life of routine. You know, he wakes up at 6:15 every morning, 6:15-ish, has a bowl of Cheerios, cup of coffee, walks to work with his lunchbox, goes to the bus depot, drives the bus, overhears interesting conversations from his passengers, returns the bus, goes home, has dinner, walks the dog. And this is what a typical day is like. But, you know, in that typical day, he finds either beautiful things or interesting things to write poems about, or to be the kind of jumping off point, the point of departure for a larger reflection. And is that the kind of poetry you find yourself especially interested in, like the poetry that reflects something of daily life?
Yes, for me, certainly. But I like that also in cinema as well. I mean, I like all forms of movies. I'm a movie geek, so I watch all kinds of films, and I read all kinds of things too. But the poetry that speaks to me the most directly will contain mundane things, will contain details. There's also a great thing in the film, I will say it's great, that Method Man, Cliff Smith, plays a rapper in a laundromat who is working out some lyrics sort of to the rhythm of a washing machine. And something about hip-hop culture, and hip-hop is the ability to use current language and slang and reference details of life is very, very strong for me. I'm a big Wu-Tang fan, and I love the Wu-Tang clan, the GZA and RZA and Method Man and Ghostface Killer and Raekwon and Old Dirty Bastard. Man, they were writing incredible stuff. Now, I think we need to sort of broaden our definition of poetry, which maybe it's a good thing that they just gave this Nobel Prize to Dylan, because blurring the lines of song lyrics and also hip-hop for me is like some of the greatest uses, most innovative uses of language in my lifetime.
When you were auditioning Adam Driver, did you have him read poems?
No, and I didn't audition him in any traditional sense. I just had lunch with him, basically. I had seen a few films he was in. I had seen maybe one episode of Girls. I loved his presence, his face, his physical presence, you know, being. But I just wanted to meet him, and then he was so kind of humble and had a really nice sense of humor, but he was kind of self-effacing, and I just loved him. So we just talked for a while, and then when I left that lunch, Ellen Lewis, who helps me cast my films always, had hooked up this lunch. So as soon as I left, I was on my phone like, Ellen, I'm in love with this guy. He's got to be Patterson. So I was just so happy to work with Adam. And Adam is great to work with for me, especially because, well, I can only speak for myself, but I'm completely intuitive and I don't like to analyze things. And I like actors who just become the person and then react. And Adam is completely reactive in that way. So every day working with him was really a pleasure. And he's in almost every scene in the film, so the poor guy had to work almost the entire 30 days of our film shoot. But, yeah, he was really a pleasure, and I really love how he embodied this character.
So because Adam Driver plays a bus driver, and there is a lot of scenes of him driving the bus, and we see things from his point of view as he's driving the bus, did you spend a lot of time driving around in a bus in Patterson to get a feel of what it looks like through a bus window?
No, I spent a lot of time driving around in cars. We would just go almost 3-4 days a week in pre-production. But then, yes, I rode on the bus quite a bit to get that feeling of elevation. I love riding on a bus now because you're looking down on the world from not a too high of an angle, but people on the street rarely look up into the bus. they're sort of oblivious to this big giant machine, you know, passing by. So there's something very beautiful about the angle that you look at the world through. So we tried to capture that and give that feeling with a lot of point of views from the side windows of the bus and from the front windows.
Did Adam Driver have to learn how to drive a bus?
Yes, Adam Driver. It's funny, we were the producers. They were preparing so that Adam could get a bus license and go to bus driving school. So we called Adam to say, okay, we set this up so you can go to bus driving school, to which Adam replied, oh, no, I've been doing that on my own. I've been in bus driving school. I've passed the written test. I have my driving test next week. I think it's going really well. So Adam is amazing. This is the same when I got the 700-page collected poems of Ron Padgett, or however big it is. I got a copy for Adam, and I called him saying, oh, I got the Ron Padgett book. I'm going to send it over to you. He said, oh, no, I've had that for several weeks. I've been immersed in Ron Padgett. I love this guy. So, you know, Adam Driver, he thinks ahead.
Oh, that's really great.
But he did drive the bus at times in the film, and I must say, very confidently. It was very stable. He's a good bus driver. He's got a, if this acting thing doesn't work out for him, he could drive a bus in New Jersey.
So, you know, the Adam Driver character, as he's preparing to begin his shift or ending his shift, he's always kind of like taking notes and writing lines of poetry or thinking about a poem. And then usually that ends with him opening the door of the bus so he can talk to the dispatcher who's telling him it's time to start. And the dispatcher always has like a tale of woe. So I thought I'd play the first version of this scene between Adam Driver and the dispatcher.
Morning, Donnie.
Ready to roll it, Patterson?
Yeah. Everything okay?
Well, now that you ask, no, not really. My kid needs braces on her teeth. My car needs a transmission job. My wife wants me to take her to Florida, but I'm behind on the mortgage payments. My uncle called from India and he needs money for my niece's wedding, and I got this strange rash on my back. You name it, brother. How about you?
I'm okay.
That was Adam Driver and Rizwan Manji in a scene from Patterson, which was written and directed by my guest, Jim Jarmusch. I saw that scene in the trailer for the movie, and I thought, I am definitely going to this film. Once he said, and I have a strange rash on my back, I thought, this is great.
Well, he's a lovely, wonderful actor.
My guest is screenwriter and director Jim Jarmusch. His new film is called Patterson. After a short break, we'll talk about his documentary Gimme Danger about the punk band Iggy and the Stooges. And David Edelstein will review the new film The Salesman by the Academy Award-winning Iranian director Asghar Farhadi. It's nominated for an Oscar, but he won't be at the ceremony because of President Trump's travel ban. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Angie's List, for more than 20 years helping consumers select local service providers, dedicated to promoting fairness and transparency about local pricing and quality, at angieslist.com. Angie's List, home is where our heart is. And from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles, at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with screenwriter and director Jim Jarmusch. His new film, Patterson, stars Adam Driver as a bus driver and poet named Patterson living in Patterson, New Jersey. Jarmusch also directed a recent documentary about the punk group Iggy and the Stooges that's named after their song Gimme Danger. The documentary had a theatrical release and is now available for streaming on Amazon. You've known Iggy Pop for a long time. You came to New York in, what, the 70s or late 60s to study?
No, I came in the mid-70s.
Mid-70s, okay. So what did punk rock mean to you when it was starting?
It meant a kind of real liberation of expression. It embraced amateurism in a way that I still am inspired by. It was not about trying to get, you know, stadium gigs or even commercial radio play or even record deals for that matter. It was about saying something because you meant it and expressing something that you felt. And that was primary for that, whatever the scene, whatever punk rock means. It was very, very important to me, very formative. And I still consider myself to be an amateur filmmaker. And I say that because In the Latin origin of the word amateur is the word love, and it's love of a form, whereas professional implies something you do for money or for work. And I'm not putting down anyone that does look at their work in that way, but for me, I am a hardcore amateur. And really, that came to me through the music scene, through, you know, I kind of grew up in my early 20s in Max's Kansas City and CBGB and these bands and that whole approach. And all the artists inspired me. The filmmaker Amos Poe was a huge inspiration for me by making guerrilla-style punk films on the streets of New York and well, it's just a lot of painters and artists and filmmakers all within that scene. And it's very, very important to me.
So did that amateur aesthetic give you permission to make movies before you felt accomplished enough to actually make them?
Yes, completely. My first film I made, Permanent Vacation, we shot in 1979 for like $12,000, part of which I got a fake car loan for that Amos Poe told me you could do that. And yeah, I had no idea what I was doing. It was just like, well, we're going to try and do this. Partly because I had been following Amos Poe and Eric Mitchell around for about a year. And I worked on some of Eric's films as a sound recordist and stuff. And they were always saying, well, Jim, when are you going to make your film? When are you going to do it? So I was like, well, I'm going to do it soon. And so I made Permanent Vacation. And I'm still trying to learn how to do it. I'm still trying to figure out how to make films. But yeah, it started then.
One of the really interesting things that Iggy Pop says in your documentary is when he was a kid, he loved Soupy Sales, the kid show host who was kind of part hipster and part vaudevillian. He was really funny and kind of transgressive for a kid show of his time. And Iggy Pop remembers Soupy telling the kids to write to him, but to keep their letters to 25 words or less. And then Iggy Pop tells you that he decided to apply that to his lyrics. So can you hear that in his lyrics?
Yes. I mean, no fun, my babe, no fun. That's four words he makes into a whole chorus. So his reductive ability to be reductive with language is very much, you know, he's very open and sincere about that coming from Soupy.
Yeah, because the funny thing is, I mean, he's so well-spoken and so smart and so kind of aware of the arts and the avant-garde. So people who don't know better might think that he wasn't as intellectual as he is.
Well, he's one of those remarkable people that is, you know, he has an incredible mind. He is very intellectual, but it's not refined by academics or school.
Exactly.
I find this too in members of the Wu-Tang Clan that are amazingly intellectual, but they come from like the streets of Staten Island, and they didn't go to Harvard or whatever, but their mental abilities are staggering and remarkable. And Iggy's like that too. He's very self-taught, self-educated, but man, that guy knows about so many things. And what's really beautiful about him and other people like that, like the Wu-Tang people too, is that he never stands on his laurels about his knowledge. Like every day is, what can I learn? What don't I know? And if something comes up, people are talking about it and he doesn't know about it, his curiosity is like antennae. He's like, well, what's that? Well, you know, he's just absorbing things. So yeah, he's a remarkable, I think he's an aberrant mutation because of his physical being and his mind. That's just not fair that he that he has that body and that mind. Come on.
Well, why don't we hear one of Iggy Pop or Iggy and the Stooges' most famous songs? And this is the song that gives your documentary its title, Gimme Danger.
Gimme danger, little stranger, and I'll give you a piece. Gimme danger, little stranger, and I'll feel your disease. There's nothing in my dreams. Just some ugly memories kiss me like the ocean breeze. Hey! Now if you will be my lover, I will shiver and sing. But if you can be my master, I will do anything. Nothing left alive but a pair of glassy eyes. Raise my feelings one more time.
Yeah. It's Iggy and the Stooges doing Gimme Danger. It's the song that gives Jim Jarmusch's documentary about the Stooges its title. Jim Jarmusch, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
Jim Jarmusch wrote and directed the new film Patterson and directed the recent documentary Gimme Danger about Iggy and the Stooges. The documentary is now available for streaming on Amazon. The Iranian film The Salesman is one of the five nominees for this year's Foreign Language Academy Award, which will be presented at the end of February. But the writer and director, Oscar Farhadi, has said he won't attend the ceremony because of President Trump's travel ban. Farhadi won an Oscar for his 2011 film, A Separation. Film critic David Edelstein has this review of The Salesman.
A woman is brutally assaulted in the early part of Oscar Farhadi's gripping Iranian drama, The Salesman. The woman, Rana, is washing up in the bathroom of her new apartment in an unfamiliar part of Tehran, just home from acting in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, where she plays Willie Loman's wife. She hears the buzzer from downstairs and thinks it's her husband, Imad, who plays Willie, so she unlocks the door and returns to what she was doing. Later, when Imad does get home, he sees blood everywhere. He finds Rana in the hospital, where the wounds on her face are being stitched. She won't talk about what happened. Not then, not a few days later. The nature of the assault, a description of the assailant, the motive, it's a blank to be filled by Imad's churning suspicions and fears. That blank is central to many of Farhadi's films. His Oscar-winning A Separation turns on a woman's unseen fall in a staircase. Not knowing what happened makes us consider the destructive social forces that helped put that woman on that staircase at that time. In my favorite movie of Farhadi's, About Ellie, a young female teacher disappears while visiting colleagues at their beach house. As they learn more about their absent guest, the focus subtly shifts to the trauma of her life, and by implication, the lives of many working single women in modern Iran. As much as whodunits, Farhadi makes whatdunits and whydunits. The director has a detached, rather clinical style, as if he's photographing specimens in a terrarium, the terrarium being a city in which artists have to watch their backs because of hovering censors. His own social criticisms are oblique. The movie begins with the imminent collapse of Rana and Imad's lovely apartment, a literal collapse, the result of apparently careless citywide construction. Their new, shabbier apartment has items belonging to the evicted previous tenant and her small child, whose bike is still there. That tenant apparently had clients, meaning Johns, and Imad suspects the person who assaulted his wife might have been one, or else was sent by the woman to harass the new tenants. When he finds a set of keys dropped by the attacker and the van parked nearby they belong to, Imad wants vengeance. But Rana is impossible to pin down. Her devastation lingers. She even insists on showering in her old collapsing apartment, but she doesn't want to go to the police. The inaction in the middle section of The Salesman is excruciating. And there's a broader aspect to the film. Slowly, we begin to see the parallels between this event and Death of a Salesman, in which Willie's son learns that his dad is seeing a prostitute, which helps drive the old man to suicide. More I cannot say, except that I didn't draw too many breaths during the last half hour. I can't praise too highly the performances of Shahab Hosseini as the increasingly fevered Imad, and longtime Farhadi collaborator Tarena Aladousti as Rana, whose wordless despair gives the movie's final section so much of its power. Fareed Sajjadi Hosseini plays an older man who shows up late and all but owns the movie. The Salesman is nominated for this year's Foreign Language Feature Academy Award, but it's unclear if Farhadi would be able to attend the ceremony given the presidential order banning citizens of certain countries from visiting the U.S. He has said, in any case, that he won't come. The good news is that the controversy has stirred up even more support for this brilliant and deeply humanist film.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, Dr. Haider Vareich, author of Modern Death, explains how life-extending medicines and technologies have also prolonged death and created complicated decisions for patients, their loved ones, and doctors. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, committed to helping its members select local service providers and professionals they can count on, offering over 20 years of ratings and reviews. Learn more at angieslist.com. Angie's List, home is where our heart is. And from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization providing educational travel adventures, including experiences for families, grandparents, and grandchildren. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. New medications and medical technologies have extended life, but for many people, these innovations have also prolonged the process of dying. Patients, loved ones, and doctors are faced with decisions about how much to intervene and when to stop. My guest, Dr. Heide Verreich, writes from a doctor's perspective about how medicine has changed the end of life. His new book is called Modern Death. He's also written medical and op-ed pieces for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and The Atlantic. Heide Verreich, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to write a book about death?
Terry, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's such a great honor, and thank you for the introduction. I wanted to write a book about death for two main reasons. The first reason was that, you know, as a physician, you know, even though I'd been to med school, I'd learned so much about life. When it came to the end of life, there were so many things that I didn't understand. I didn't understand how things had evolved to be the way they were. And I really wanted to find answers to some very, very basic questions, like, what are the implications of the sort of life extension that we have achieved? What is the role of religion, not only patient's religion, but a physician's religion when it comes to dealing with the end of life? You know, how is social media affecting how people experience the end of life? I also wanted to write a book in which patients and their family members could learn about what the landscape of the end of life looks like with the advent of modern technology. So many times I found myself in the room where there are people who were so much more experienced in life than I was, yet knew so little about death and dying. And so I wanted to write a book so that people could go into those really, really difficult places and feel like they have they're armed with information, that this isn't a completely foreign territory for them. And that in some way could help them navigate and deal with the sort of difficult situations that lay ahead for them.
One of the ways that life is extended now is through feeding tubes mm-hmm. in hospitals and nursing homes. That's a really tough decision for loved ones to make. Sometimes the patient himself or herself can be in on the decision, but sometimes they have dementia or some other problem that's preventing them from really participating in the decision making. So you had an op-ed that was headlined "Force Feeding Cruel at Gitmo, But Okay for Our Parents." And the implication of that, to me, reading it, was like, wow, if you approve a feeding tube for your parents, it's like force feeding them, like at Gitmo or something. It's like a really torturous, horrible thing to do. So, like, how bad is feeding through a tube? How invasive a procedure is that?
The headline was not my choice, but specifically the piece that I wanted to address was the use of tube feedings in patients who have dementia. So tube feedings have a role in certain settings. For example, if you have a stroke and you are unable to swallow and you need nutrition of some sort, tube feeding is probably the best option for nutrition at that point. It is better than nutrition through an IV. It is better than feeding you solid food that you may aspirate and which could cause pneumonia. And there's some other settings in which tube feedings certainly have a role. But one of the biggest groups in the United States and other developed countries who get tube feeds are patients who have dementia. And why that is problematic is that study after study has shown that patients with dementia who have feeding tubes actually do not do any better. If anything, they do worse than patients who do not have tube feeding. There is studies that show that patients who are getting tube feeds are more likely to have pressure ulcers. And some studies have shown that there's even no nutritional benefit. And the reason some have surmised or have hypothesized is that the lack of nutrition or the lack of eating is in fact a symptom of a very terminal disease that we just cannot overcome by pushing pureed tube feeds through a tube that goes either down the nose or through the stomach.
You describe a case where a patient, I'm forgetting exactly what the interventions were, but they were about to get, I think, a respirator. It was a respirator or a feeding tube, but it was some kind of tube. And the patient opened his eyes and said to you, "Kill me." Would you tell us the story of that patient, and how do you respond when a patient says that to you? When, what can you do? I mean, is that a directive? Is that officially a directive from a patient to stop interventions? Or is that something that you ignore because you might think, oh, the patient's not in their right mind now, they can't make a really rational decision?
Terry, this is one of the one stories, one encounters that I had in residency that I've been unable to shake from my memory. This was a patient who had a dementia. In fact, this patient barely spoke any English, even when he didn't have dementia, and in fact hadn't spoken for weeks or even months, according to the family. And the patient was very, very sick, and the family had requested that we place a feeding tube to help him eat, so to speak. And reluctantly, but respecting the family's wishes, we proceeded with placing the feeding tube through the nose. Now, I will say that even though it sounds innocuous, placing a feeding tube through the nose that goes down to the stomach is one of the most uncomfortable procedures that many patients will undergo. In any case, I was the resident supervising the intern, and the intern was one of the best interns that I've ever worked with. She was extremely proficient, very humane, very empathetic, and she was going through the steps of the placing the feeding tube just perfectly. But as she started to swivel the feeding tube, which is a long rubber tube, up the patient's nostril, the patient, who had been almost still, almost unresponsive before that, came to life in a very strong and powerful way. His eyes were wide open, and he was looking right at us. And he started to scream. He started to scream to us, "Kill me." And he kept saying that again and again. And I didn't know what to make of it. The patient obviously had dementia. The patient was very, very sick. And yet, that story still stays with me. The patient's family was all standing there right next to us. And it was very clear what they wanted. And it was very clear that the patient had no capacity to be able to make medical decisions for himself. How does one resolve that story? How do I erase that memory from the intern who was doing that procedure in the most appropriate way possible? I don't know. And I think if you ask any physician, any nurse, any paramedic, they'll have many such stories to tell you.
So what did you do?
We ended up completing the procedure as we had been instructed by the patient's family. You know, it was clear to us that the patient did not have capacity to make medical decisions. He did have pretty end-stage dementia. He could barely swallow. He hadn't spoken in months, and even afterwards, he didn't speak much at all. So we ended up doing exactly what had been requested of us by the family.
But you suspect that when he said "kill me," that really came from his very essence, that he really meant it. But you had to overrule it?
I don't know if it came from his essence, but it did affect mine. It did affect mine. It did give me a lot to think about. It was actually the reason why I ended up writing that op-ed, was because I still don't know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Haider Vareich, author of the new book, Modern Death, How Medicine Changed the End of Life. He's Pakistani and first came to America to study internal medicine at Harvard Medical School and do his residency at the Harvard Teaching Hospital, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's now a fellow in cardiology at Duke University Medical Center. His parents continue to live in Pakistan. We recorded this interview a couple of days before President Trump issued his executive order restricting immigration and travel from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Pakistan is not one of those countries. Do you have concerns now in the President Donald Trump era about your ability to travel back and forth to Pakistan to see your family that's still there, or your family's ability to come here to visit you and then return home?
Well, you know, I will say that, you know, I came to the United States in 2010 and have only lived in an America in which Barack Obama was the president. I think in some ways, Trump's victory has, you know, really shaken me because of how invested I was in the idea that America is the special place. It's a truly multicultural society. And I'm still trying to understand, I think like so many others, just exactly what happened. You know, especially as a writer and as a physician, I've tried to separate myself from my identity as a Muslim. You know, I would rather be known as a physician, scientist, writer who, you know, happens to be Pakistani rather than a young Pakistani Muslim immigrant who happens to be a doctor and a writer. But I don't know, given how things are changing, I'm not even sure if I will be able to set that narrative for myself. And that's a scary thought, to live an identity that is so politicized, even when you wish for it to not be.
You know, you described, I forget whether this was in your book or in an article, that on the day of the Boston Marathon bombing, as the bombs were exploding, you were basically like across the street at a food court in the Prudential Center on Boylston Street. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody's just like shocked and not sure what to do. You were there with your wife and some friends. And at that point, you felt both like a victim and a suspect. What were you worried about?